Thank you, Amaro.
Do you have any presentation?
There are a couple of things I need to mention about the slides before I start. Number one, there are far too many of them, and I'm not going to cover them all in detail. Number two, they're kind of upside down in terms of organization. Usually we talk about the administrative part of something like the Interpretations Committee before we talk about the technical part. The reason I've reversed them is because the message I would like you to take away from what I have to tell you in about the next 30 minutes or so is the degree to which the activities of the Interpretations Committee reflect what you have asked us to do. And I think that's a relatively new development, the degree to which the Interpretations Committee is dealing with issues that are arising from the folks in this room. And to the degree that our operating principles allow me to do so, I'm going to point some of you out as the initiators of some of these issues. The reason I mentioned the detail about administrative procedures is we have a standing policy that if a person or an organization submits an issue to us and asks for confidentiality, we grant it. That policy is not going to change, period. And there's a good reason. If we changed it, the number of issues that reached us would decline by, in my estimation, 75%. And we have to make this process risk-free for people who want to get issues to us but prefer not to be identified. And frankly, the identity isn't all that important, except the degree to which it serves my purpose in pointing out to you the degree to which all of you are already involved. Now, I've listed a few issues on this slide. Flipping to the first one, an oldie but a goodie, one that is a favorite topic of many of you, and that's IFRIC 15. This is one that I think I have more scar tissue over from more beatings received in more jurisdictions than any other Interpretations Committee matter. It is unusual in that we even took part of this to the board and asked for the board's guidance on how it should proceed. IFRIC 15 in many jurisdictions has been interpreted by certainly the audit firms to mean that it is impossible to get continuous delivery accounting on an off-plan sale. The staff does not believe that to be universally true, but it's been difficult to resolve it. And so we actually went to the board after having heard and talked to many people about this, and the board actually advised the committee not to do anything more in the expectation that the revenue recognition project would, number one, solve the problem, and number two, be sufficiently timely to be available for people who wanted it when it became available. We are aware that some jurisdictions in their path to adoption have seen this issue as a significant obstacle. I'm going to pass over levies. This next one is an example of one in which practice can differ even when a standard is identical. And that has to do with IFRS 3 and what used to be FAS 141, and Tom, I don't remember the codification system. I'm too old to learn it. The standard is identical on this topic. And one of the interesting things that we found when we started to examine it, especially in the context of our investment properties standard, is that the practice interpretation was diametrically opposite. That in the United States, something that would have qualified as an investment property under RIAS 40 the vibe that we got, or the information that we got, was that uniformly that was viewed as a business, and therefore falling fully under the business combination standard. What we found when we looked at practice in other parts of the world was that the interpretation was not that at all, that people tended to differentiate between different types of things. As we have dealt with this in the context of several issues now, it is becoming increasingly clear, though, just the number of problems that our definition of a business language creates. Now, having said that, I'll be cursed if I know how to make it better. But we do know that it is proving very difficult in practice. The next one I want to talk to you about is contingent pricing of property, plant, and equipment. Now, this one has been on the Interpretations Committee's agenda so long that I'm not sure any of us remember where it came from originally. But one of the interesting variations and a source of absolutely fascinating input was originated in Brazil with one of the largest service concession companies, IFRIC 12, operating both in Brazil and around the world. And for them, this was an absolutely critical issue because the structure of the tolls that they collect on roads are almost always indexed to inflation. So they looked at that and said, well, you know, if we have to recognize that as a liability, and we are under IAS 39, which we normally would be for a financial liability, what happens when that index kicks in? Well, the IAS 39 accounting is pretty straightforward. Credit liability for the next 30 years of inflation, debit expense. That's what 39 says. Nobody believes that's absolutely the best answer all of the time. And that's one of the reasons that the committee has struggled with this issue over a long series of meetings. As a matter of fact, the challenge that we put to the committee at the last meeting was, it's time to talk about whether or not we should sunset this issue. If we have worked on it this long and can't get an answer, maybe we ought to quit. And so one of the challenges that the staff has for the next committee meeting is to come back with an analysis of why we shouldn't quit and whether or not there is a path to an answer. As it happens right now, if you look carefully through IFRS, there are at least three and potentially four accounting models for this kind of situation. I mentioned IAS 39. IAS 37, and especially read in conjunction with Interpretation 1, gives you a debit to an asset rather than a debit to expense. The board's leasing project would tend to tell you that you compute the effect of the index differently than you would under IAS 39. And you debit the asset. So we have a problem here, but it hasn't become clear how to solve it. The important part, again, for purposes of this discussion, was the role of Brazil in highlighting the interactions between this problem, which started out as a business combination problem, I think, and service concession arrangements, and whether or not you recognize a liability for parts of a service concession. Scanning down this next one, I'm going to pick and choose. The first one I'm going to pick is land rights. I had planned to anyway, but Rosita mentioned it, and this one did come from Indonesia by way of our emerging economies group. It proved very difficult, and we were very lucky that IHRSA, the former technical director of the Indonesian board, happened to be in the audience when we first talked about this issue. And we broke precedent when we realized how stupid we were with regard to Indonesian real estate law, and actually invited IHRSA to participate in the conversation. Now, one of the things this highlights is that if you bring a question to the Interpretations Committee, you need to be prepared for the fact that the answer may not be the one you want. Now, all of us with children recognize that our children knew that when they were growing up, and that's why they said, why they didn't ask if it was okay to take the cat into the shower or something like that. But the lesson is still one that if you ask, the Interpretations Committee is going to do everything in its power to answer. And in this particular situation, their answer was that this was a lease, not a purchase of property, plant, and equipment. Now, the thing that they didn't answer, and I'm not sure we have the ability to answer, is whether or not that makes a difference. It makes a difference depending on how you think about renewals. If you think renewals are effectively frictionless and indefinite, it doesn't matter whether you call this a finance lease or a purchase of land. If you think, on the other hand, that you cannot anticipate renewals, then it matters a lot because you wind up amortizing over the first lease period, which something like 20 years or something in that vicinity. We couldn't resolve that. The next one on the list also came from Indonesia with a substantial contribution from Brazil again. Especially personally, I have to acknowledge from Nelson. The question was whether or not a telecommunications tower qualifies as an investment property. Not one that's appeared in a lot of jurisdictions, but it appeared in Indonesia. And as it turns out, there is a developing business model around going into business to just build these things, hook up the electricity, and then lease the space. You say, well, that sounds like an investment property held primarily for rent or capital appreciation. Problem is that the parenthetical comment in IAS 40 uses the word building. And one of these is not a building. We even consulted specialists in the International Building Code. And they said, no, it's a structure, but it's not a building. So we're going to have to bring this one back and talk about it again. But this is a circumstance in which we may have to kick it to the board and say, okay, where do you want to put the pressure? Do you want to put the pressure on the word building, or do you want to put the pressure on the held for rental or capital appreciation? And by the way, it's affixed to the land as well. So we'll have to get back to this one. Financial instruments with a negative yield came out of Southeast Asia and one of the central banks in that area. Not an issue that a lot of people are seeing, but I think one that a lot of people are worrying about. What happens when you buy a bond and in fact the yield is negative? And here the Interpretations Committee said, well, you know, if that happens, it ain't interest income because it's not a credit. It's not interest expense, because interest expense is something that happens to liabilities, not assets. So it's something else, and you probably need, if it's material, to make a pretty good description of it. But we did clarify that, and again, this was reasoning dictated by, number one, IAS 39, and number two, the framework, that led us to the inescapable conclusion that you cannot have negative interest income generated by a particular asset. Finally, the last on this list that I want to mention, the valuation of biological assets came from Bei Ling and her colleagues at the Malaysian Accounting Standards Board, one of several issues that they've sent forward to us. This was an unusual issue in that when we last talked about it with the committee vote was absolutely even between two conflicting views. The issue arises if you have bearer biological assets that are being operated, to use that term, on land that has a very high alternative value. Read land very close to a major metropolitan area that could be redeveloped as apartment buildings or office buildings or garages. One view would be that the highest and best use principle applies and that you have to value the plants and the land together. And as a consequence of that, the residual value that is attributed to the plants is zero or very close to it. The alternative view is that no, those plants have a positive cash flow. And IAS 41 is not looking for the value of the land, it's looking for the value of the biological assets. And so anything that has a positive cash flow axiomatically does not have a fair value of zero. As I say, this is unusual in my tenure in that the committee split absolutely evenly. And so this is an issue that we may not be able to do much more with. We may not just, we've reached an impasse on it, and it's another one that we may just have to quit. Okay. Now that I've given you a taste for some of the issues that we deal with and the degree to which those issues are increasingly sourced from you. I didn't mention Korea. We've had issues from them. I didn't mention Mexico. We've had issues from them. Probably am forgetting somebody else in the audience. My point being that this committee no longer deals exclusively, if it ever did, with issues that are originating either with the major accounting firms or with securities regulators. To a very large degree, you are the source of our issues, and you're the people we're interested in. Now, what is this committee? For those of you who don't follow my fascinating work life all the time, it's a committee of 14 members. They are not paid. So this is 14 people who commit to meeting once every 2 months and to doing probably a week of preparation in advance of that meeting. So for zero compensation, other than their travel costs, many of them are committing to 12 weeks a year of very difficult work. That's a pretty heroic commitment for someone to make. We pay their travel costs, and that's it. If the committee tragically has a non-voting chair, but that probably is the best way for it to be, and I try my hardest not to let my personal views intercede until everybody else has had a say. It's too much to ask me to keep my mouth shut when I have a view, but I do try and keep it to a minimum until everyone else has had a say. They're from a variety of countries. I probably would leave somebody out, but we have People's Republic of China, Japan, a couple from Europe, New Zealand, a couple of Americans, pretty lively bunch. All four of the major accounting firms are represented on the committee. I think you recognize that it wouldn't work if they weren't, that you have to have at least those four players. The interesting thing I find about that, though, is the degree to which the four personalities do not behave as mouthpieces for their respective firms' views. Matter of fact, I've been reading comment letters on two recent exposure drafts, and I know what the person at the committee said, and I'm reading the firm's comment letter, and it's not the same thing. I think that speaks very highly for both their independence and their professionalism. One of the things that we've done in the past year and a half is to try and focus the committee's operation on finding the least cost, most efficient way to put guidance into the marketplace. We're in the business of trying to help people get the answers to questions. We're not in the business of obscuring, we hope, issues. Now, when the committee started out, its mandate was pretty much to develop interpretations or to do nothing. That was pretty much all it had available to it. Later, we added the idea of the annual improvements project. We also now have the permission of the board on occasion to undertake the field work, the legwork, on a narrow scope project and then to recommend to the board what the scope of that project would be and how it would work. We also, and we haven't done this one yet, have the ability to recommend implementation guidance either to be included in the mandatory guidance in a standard or to be included as additional educational material, perhaps through Mike Wells's operation. Haven't really explored that one as much as we could, but I think we have a couple of possibilities coming up, perhaps one on cash flow statements that may lend themselves. And finally, we can explain what we think through an agenda decision. Now, a couple of things that are important to remember about agenda decisions. They do not impose the requirement for a change in an accounting policy. They are the opinion of 14 people sitting around a table in a room. That does not have sufficient due process to impose a change in an accounting policy, although we recognize that some securities regulators take the view that that's good enough, we want you to change. That's certainly within the authority of a national securities regulator. By the way, somebody should have said, turn off your damn cell phone. Securities regulators. Yeah. Next, if we have an opinion, we say so, and we tell you what it is. There have been, from time to time, some of you who would have preferred that our agenda decisions just say, no, we're not going to do it, and not go into what we think the answer is. The inherent difficulty of that is that that would not provide useful information to anyone in this room who is not a member of the Interpretations Committee cognoscenti. Read the four major firms and the other participants in the meeting itself. That's not consistent with being helpful to people. Finally, the Interpretations Committee will never describe something as a correction of an error. That is the Scarlet A, for those of you familiar with that author, that we are not going to brand on anybody. There's too much litigation risk involved with that characterization. There are too many bad outcomes, including the potential that the chairman of the committee might be named as a defendant. We're not going to do that. Again, if we did, the predictable result would be we wouldn't get questions because no one would be willing to run the risk. So we're not going to go there. Now, one pitch for one other thing, and that's my other day job. The Interpretations Committee is, for many questions, the best place to go for an answer. It's not always the best place to go for an answer, especially if you're dealing with some of the problems that typically beset jurisdictions that are in the process of adoption of IFRSs. And that inevitably creates a plethora of issues that somebody needs to think about and that probably can be worked out, but that don't rise to the level of needing to get 14 people to look at it in London. And that's in large part the role of the Director of International Activities, and that's me. We have two simple rules. We only go where we're asked. So don't expect Upton to show up on your doorstep uninvited, because it's not the way we operate. If it would be useful for us to sit down and to devote a day or 2 days to talking through an agenda of issues, then we're certainly willing to do that. As long as you recognize that my opinion in £5 will get you a sandwich at one of the shops in the neighborhood here. Of course, you can buy the same sandwich without my opinion, and it still costs you £5. Second, we only go where we have an agenda so that we know what we're going to be dealing with. That's just a matter of efficiency. And so if you have a list of 10 questions, then it probably would be efficient for me, or in some cases me and a board member, to travel to your jurisdiction to sit down with you and see if we can work them through. My experience, and this has been true, for example, in Brazil, certainly been true in Korea and in Japan, is that many of these issues, when you've talked about them for a while, tend toward consensus, and what seemed to be a very difficult problem tends to resolve itself over the course of a discussion. If it doesn't, we can always kick it upstairs to the Interpretations Committee. The emphasis in all of this is to help us understand what your problems are with particular IFRSs. Sometimes it takes repeated beatings for us to understand this and fully appreciate it, as was the case with IFRIC 15. But as we came to better understand it, we realized we needed to do something about it, potentially, and that's why the committee took the unprecedented step of consulting with the board. Our job is always to help people. Now, there's an old American joke that says the worst news in the world is I'm from the Internal Revenue Service and I'm here to help you. I hope you will think not of us as the sheriff or the policeman or the tax man, but as somebody who really wants to help. And finally, and most importantly, to carry back what we learned to the board. I don't ever go to one of these things without reporting back to the board, telling them what I've heard, my observations on it, for good or ill, so that they have a basis to incorporate that individually in their thinking on the topics that we discuss. So with that, I have exhausted my allotted 30 minutes. I suppose, given that we're short of running early, I could take a couple of questions, if anybody has some. Going once. Oh, Kevin, come on.
It'll be helpful, Wayne. Is there any guidance you can give to us about when you send a question out related to an agenda item and you're looking for background research, is there any guidance you want to give to us about how we should be approaching people locally? And I hadn't thought about this before earlier this week, where it was pointed out that if we trot off to the Big Four and ask them what they think about an issue, we're probably going to replicate what you're hearing many, many times. Maybe not, given what you said before. But I think the issue was expressed that you weren't totally sure how we were handling the issues. That's one side of the equation. The other side of the equation was For some time, we received the message that if we've got an issue in a region, we would be advised to research the issue in the region and then put it to IFRIC. When we get these letters from the staff seeking comment, which we think are a brilliant improvement, we're not always sure whether the region's getting them in toto. So we spend a bit of time trying to work out who's got the letter and how we should coordinate the response.
Yeah, and that's been a source of some frustration to the IFRIC staff because we're not always certain that the responses that we get back are as informed as they might be. When somebody answers back within 24 hours and says, we don't have any diversity in practice, you say, not absolutely certain that you've done your homework on that one. It's not always obvious to us that a standard setter, after all of the good things I've said about standard setters, is best positioned to answer a question about diversity in practice. Because standard setting doesn't typically involve monitoring practice on an ongoing basis. Because of that, we've expanded this outreach to include securities regulators. ESMA, IOSCO, anybody else that we can identify, who may be a little bit closer to the ground than the standard setters are. So I think the outreach that we did last week at the organization that used to be known as the National Standard Setters was more a fact-seeking exercise of trying to understand when we send that email out what people are doing with it. I hope that's responsive. It's kind of rambling, but I hope it's responsive. Yes, Steve.
Thank you, Wayne. As a full adoption country, Korea has a lot of urgent issues to be answered by the interpretations committee, and many companies and auditors do not trust our board, as you may understand it. I understand that your current situation is like with the non-standing committee members, with just a few staff members. It's hard to answer all the urgent questions around the world. So is there a possibility that making your committee, standing committee, with the standing members, and also with a large enough size of staff members to answer all the questions from the world? So what's your thought on it, and what is the foundation's position on that?
Well, it is a standing committee. The members are appointed for specific terms. So we don't have rotating membership at every meeting. We have the same group of people. Whether or not it should be paid people, you have to take that up with the trustees. They handle the money. I don't. I suspect they would tell you that the money isn't there for that sort of thing. I think we're better off in terms of the quality of the committee by bringing in people who are active in practice. Those of us who are standard setters are often criticized for living in an ivory tower, and far too often that criticism is valid. So having somebody who has to go home the next day and say no to a client is a very robust process in my mind. In terms of the size of the staff and the volume of work that we have, I do not believe we are overworked today. I do not believe that we have too much to do. Now, I've been saying that for the past 18 months, and I have yet to be proven wrong. So if any jurisdiction has what they believe are important issues that need to come to the Interpretations Committee and that cannot be dealt with more efficiently in some other means, send them in. if the work level gets too hard, we'll tell you when we need to start bailing out the boat. But right now, we're not overworked, so we can handle the load. One more question, if anybody has one. None appearing. Amaro, back to you.
Thank you very much, Wayne. Very interesting topics, as you see. I've been following some discussions in the Interpretation Committee chaired by Wayne. The level of independence and the quality of the discussion is really very impressive, actually. And I do agree with Wayne. We have challenges, and the Interpretation Committee can help us in addressing them in a timely basis. And I very much agree with Wayne. If you do have issues that you believe is an issue that must be discussed, in your understand, should be directed to the Interpretation Committee to be discussed more thoroughly with people that are in the practice, I would encourage you to do so. So with that, I would welcome Paul Cherry, the chairman of the IFRS Advisory Council, to provide you an update of the recent discussions.
Thank you, Amaro. Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Just to assure you that the Advisory Council is alive and I think functioning reasonably well, I would ask you to raise your sights a bit. We are not a technical body, and I have to keep reminding members of that. Our role as a council is to provide advice, not to make decisions, and to concentrate on matters of a strategic importance, the relative priorities, and increasingly we are spending as much or more time on matters that relate to the trustees as to the board itself. And personally, I find that very refreshing and encouraging. As I mentioned, we met earlier this week. Size is always an issue. We are large, not nearly as large as this group, but we are pushing around 50 people. And from time to time, some have said, make it smaller. On the other hand, we have an enormous queue of people wanting to join. I think on balance, bearing in mind we are not there to make decisions, but rather to provide advice, in my experience, the best advice comes from getting the full range of views. My sense is the size is sort of gelled around this number, not likely to shrink. On the other hand, realistically, if it grows much larger, we're just not going to have time for people to come and express their views, make sure we understand their views. So my sense is the composition, there is no absolute here. It will shift over time, and I think that's right. As circumstances change and the growth of IFRS expands, which we expect will continue, we'll have to constantly revisit the composition and the size of the council. If I were to say right now, as we were discussing with the trustees, what areas would we target wishing to have greater representation? Clearly the emerging markets, and clearly I think the SME sector is not represented the way it should. Easy to say that, much tougher to find people who have the time, and we're unpaid. We don't get our travel expenses paid either, Wayne, so it's an even worse deal than the one before. We just announced the appointment of 6 new members taking effect in 2013 as of January 1st. I don't want you to go away saying there's a stampede to the exit, but rather to the contrary, we recognize the need to have fresh views and orderly transition. So indeed, this is the first year in which the trustees have implemented staggered terms. So I would caution you and put out the invitation. We will have 20 and perhaps slightly more than 20 opportunities for new members whose term will begin January of 2014. It takes time to canvass, find the people, but please do not hesitate to make expressions of interest known as early as possible. There are a couple of points I want to address here to sort of dispel some misconceptions. 4 or 5 years ago, and Nelson would certainly know this, having chaired this group before, users were seriously underrepresented. It is an enormous challenge to draw that sector into debate. The trustees reached out. We continue to reach out. We now have a significant slice here, much higher than it would have been a few years ago. I think, and I did this partly to push back on some of my preparer friends who say, it's the users who are being overrepresented, say, well, not actually quite so. And also we have regulators, standard setters, other, we're trying to reach out more to the academic community. I think there may be an opportunity here, if I look out in the next couple of years, to reconsider this composition in light of things that we're discussing at this session. For example, the Accounting Standards Forum that's being contemplated is another important new mechanism that will allow standard setters to form their views. I think, assuming that goes ahead, we'll have to ask ourselves, well, right now we're blessed with a number of standard setters on our group. I'd hate to see that disappear, but on the other hand, maybe there will be opportunities to take advantage of that new channel of communication with the Accounting Standards Setters Forum. The regional bodies, a very important development, and one that we certainly welcome. And again, I think we need to think about how the council interacts with those regional bodies to perhaps make sure that we're not duplicating efforts and to take maximum advantage of what's going on. Another misconception, and this just depends on where you are, the forces of good or evil. If I was back home, people would say it's Europe driving the thing. And if I was, as I am here, say, it's those Americans. And I'm saying, I think this is reflecting the shifting dynamics, both in terms of the IFRS family and the shifting global economies and our marketplace. And I view this as very positive. Asia Oceania, a major player. Now, you may say, what happened to the Americans? We thought there were more than that. I would point you to what I'm calling the international organizations. And again, this is an effort to reach out to large groups and take advantage of what they do internally to get the views of their stakeholders. And I see this as positive. So where they come from, where the member comes from, is of real no particular importance because they come charged with an obligation to consult internally and to take the broader global view. Give you an example. We have representatives from IOSCO, a global organization. So, and this is my personal analysis. Others could do it quite differently. But I put them in the international. On the other hand, ESMA, an important group, clearly with a mandate dealing with Europe, I put in the European category. So that gives you a sense of, I think, the increasing global focus. Now, we don't want that to the exclusion of individual countries and regions. It's an ongoing challenge to try and keep some balance. And obviously, if you look here, there are some areas, regions, that are seriously underrepresented. We're aware of that, need to work on it. And again, it just takes time. So if it hasn't happened yet, please don't give up on us. It's not that we aren't trying, but it does take time to change some of these arrangements. And I would hope, for example, we're sensitive to the Middle East, Africa, just off the top of my head, South America. I was pleased that in the recent appointments, we now have members coming from Mexico and from Spain, which brings countries not previously represented in the council in the last 4 years or so. So it's an ongoing struggle to get the right mix of things. Looking at the sorts of things council has been dealing with, we keep asking ourselves, there's no point in coming if we're not going to be relevant, that we want to have an impact, feel that we're making a contribution, and that it's useful. The one I cite first and foremost is the strategy review and the monitoring board review, and I see that really as almost the poster child of how the interaction of the council with the trustees and the board should go. In those instances, there was ample opportunity the trustees and the board came to the council well in advance of having formed preliminary reviews, came back to us, having heard our initial advice, explained how they had taken our views into consideration. And indeed, if you look at the public documents, there is now an increasing emphasis on demonstrating that the view that the consultation has taken place, the views have been considered, and at the end of the day, the board of the trustees are the decision makers, not the council. But I'm really pleased with that, and I think the agenda consultation worked equally well in terms of the process. And when I say the outcomes, I'm not saying that the council is saying, yeah, we agree that you've got the list right. It's much more that there has been a feedback, that there is transparency of the process. A topic that we spent a fair bit of time on, and will continue to do so, is what I call the network of the various parties who have a stake in IFRS, building the global network. At our meeting earlier this week, we had a senior representative of the Financial Stability Board. You might say, gee, that's obvious. In the last few years, what topic has generated so much controversy, so much interest in financial reporting? And there is a lot going on, but the Financial Stability Board is not represented on council at the moment. And after that presentation, got me to thinking, well, maybe, if not as a member, there should be some ongoing relationship that makes sure that we're sensitive to their needs. Integrated reporting. Not the first time it was on our agenda. We had another session and another with the Basel Banking Committee. And that's the sort of thing that we want to reach out. We have valuations on our list. Be interesting. Sir David's alive and well and chairing the international the trustees, as I understand it, for the valuations group. And that's another natural connection, in my judgment, that the council is trying to be sensitive to what's happening, and who the players are, and making sure we understand their issues and concern. Another one that I didn't put on here, but I feel is quite an accomplishment, and I'm not giving the council any credit for this at all, but there has been a significant change in this organization in the last 12 to 18 months. At, you know, the leadership levels, the growth in the organization, and it has been, I think, a remarkably seamless transition. And I think that is a significant accomplishment. It didn't happen by accident, and so I give certainly the ISB and the trustees much credit for having done that. Looking ahead and saying, well, where will we be spending our energies for the next little while? We're all growing weary of the remaining four projects. Earlier this week, I think what we find refreshing is perhaps a more candid assessment of what the real prospects are on these four. The leasing project seemed to us a very positive assessment, down to perhaps important tweaking, but substantially complete. Likewise with revenue recognition. Then with insurance, the message became more difficult to interpret. Still working towards consensus on key projects. And some council members asking, you know, it's time, this has been going on much too long. And what does it take to get closure on the file, was the message. On impairment, the sense, this is very non-technical, but my reading of the council members was convergence is essential. There is no perfect answer to this, but a converged answer, if it requires one or both boards to move, was the sense that I had coming from that conversation. We had identified in the agenda consultation this period of calm, it's not a great term, but you can blame that one on council. That sort of came out of some of our earlier discussions. But consistent interpretation and application of IFRS was really the number one priority that the council identified about a year and a half ago, saying for the next few years, that should be the prime, completing the four MOU projects, then concentrating on getting consistent interpretation application. An important marker came out at our council meeting earlier this week is seeking consistency is not the same as dealing with enforcement. And we've got to bear that in mind, that it's not the board's mandate to get into enforcement. If we can do things that facilitate others in that exercise, well and good. The standard setting processes, working with the national standard setters, I mentioned earlier the idea that the creation of an accounting standard setters forum was discussed with council. I think the council had identified a need to reevaluate the current arrangements in light of changing circumstances, and there would probably be a more efficient way of making greater use of the national bodies. And I guess that's the message I would have here. It's not an attempt to knock people out of the conversation, to exclude them from the process, but much more a question actually of trying to make the best use of people's time in a way that we're not tripping over one another, duplicating efforts. Disclosure, I put overload in quotation marks. You'll be no surprise that there's a view amongst some of our user members and others, and that's really not fair. Many others feel that the issue really is not overload. It's rather the garbled communications, the mishmash of trivial and important stuff with no differentiation between the two. This is something the council has been discussing, whether the issue really is overload or whether it requires more structure. The advice of the council was that a standard setter cannot solve this problem. It may not even be a standard setting problem as such. It's as much a behavior problem and a legal liability issue. So the advice of the council was that the board should take a leadership role, invite the various interested parties to get together and come up with a coordinated effort to try and solve this problem. And the council urged some of the individual projects to stand down, and that it was not as simple as just going through and hitting the delete button on a bunch of the presently required disclosures. So I'm very pleased. I think I've heard mention, I'm sorry, I'm forgetting now whether it might have been at the council meeting or earlier today, but I believe there will be a forum convened by the end of January on disclosure, which is, I think, would be a step in the right way. The comprehensive review of the IFRS for SMEs, we've spent a lot of time. It was a very interesting session this morning. We're sensitive that most of the council's discussions is in the context of large companies and the major capital markets. We're sensitive to that issue. We're trying to elevate the prominence and give appropriate attention to the SME sector. I see this comprehensive review as an ideal opportunity to get the council more actively engaged in this sector, and look forward to that process. Standard level project proposals. The council's advice was there ought not to be very many. So this is definitely a case where less is more. And in fact, the two that we had targeted in light of the board's evaluation of its agenda consultation were the investment company and the rate regulated activities. Both of those were and agriculture. So the agriculture and rate regulated were on the council's agenda for earlier this week. So my sense is that will be most of what we'll be spending the next year or so on, barring there are always unexpected developments. We're always looking for appropriate agenda items, and you should please feel free to make suggestions if you have a member locally, or if not, Jan Baldur is the staff member here at the ISB, or Michael Stewart, Alan Teixeira, me, if you can find my email address, be delighted to have suggestions as to things that you think the council should be dealing with. But we are trying to elevate our profile. I think the interaction, one of the complaints, and I'm sure this would resonate with Nelson, was there was a sense earlier on that the board and the trustees weren't listening to the council. I don't hear that anymore. To the contrary, I think the dialogue has improved considerably, and I think we've learned to pick the spots that make appropriate use of the council's time. So, Amara, I'd be happy to take questions or comments if time allows. Nelson.
Thank you, Paul. I have a question, but before that, I think it's appropriate for me to publicly recognize the improvement of the Advisory Council under your chairmanship. I noticed from a prudent distance that you're monitoring the group and steering them quite effectively. And the one improvement that I can admit publicly is that the English spoken by the chairman improved dramatically. there was something that you mentioned in your presentation that struck me, and perhaps you could share the views or how you and the trustees and the board intend to address. I didn't have the information about the retirement or the 20 people leaving the council during 2013. And, of course, rotating almost half of the group is something that should be in the worries of everyone, to the extent that some continuation may be compromised in that respect. Is there anything that you have in views towards that to mitigate the negative effects?
Well, you're right, Nelson. It seems a bit high, but it was caused by the fact that the initial appointments all had everyone expiring on the same date. And we said, you know, that's not workable. You can't turn over 50 people at once. We could easily put out a projection that shows the expiry. The usual deal is members are appointed for a three-year term, eligible for one reappointment, so maximum of 6 years. To get onto the rotation, some members were appointed for 1 year, reappointed for 1 year. Those were the six who came from your group, who were there really as mentors to us new members to ease the transition to the new council. So we've lost the benefit of them. And so there, the next 2 years we'll see unusually large waves as a result of that initial fact that everyone had the same term of appointment. Going forward, it will be less extreme. But if it helps people, I mean, that could easily be done to see not only the individuals, but you could see their background, whether they are preparers or users. Not necessarily that, or no one owns a seat, and over time, you know, the balance will clearly change. But, yeah. And thank you for your kind words. Any other comments or questions? All right, well, thank you very much for your attention.
Thank you very much, Paul. I did have the opportunity to attend this week meeting of the Advisory Council. I think it was very constructive, very positive, I guess. And for us in the board, we take very seriously, as Paul mentioned, the advice from these groups. Highly effective group in the way they work and provide update to us. Or advice to us. And then this brings us to the close of the business today in this very room. I have a number of issues that I have to say here according to my list. One is remind you that the main conference will be back here in this very same room tomorrow at 9 a.m. For the main conference. However, to the optional early bird meeting on XBRL, this will be at Crown Suite, the very same floor, at 8 a.m. So for the ones who are interested in learning a little bit with or following what's going on in XBRL. And also a very last comment that we'll have the dinner tonight at 6:30 p.m. sharp. It's a very early dinner for some, but this is the traditional way, and in order to have you rested and fully charged tomorrow at 9 a.m. With that, I thank you very, very much for your attendance, not only for being here again, but for participating actively during the whole day. We still have coffee and tea in the back of this room. We have a question here. Oh, dinner is in the Crown Suite in this floor as well at 6:30 p.m. Sorry. Well, thank you very much. See you at dinner or tomorrow at 9 a.m.